Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's hard not to worry about ticks when you're out in the woods and fields these days. We've been hearing reports, both locally and nationally, of a dramatic rise in the number of diagnosed cases of Lyme disease in the last decade, and other less well-known diseases spread by ticks are also picking up steam. If you're not paying attention to ticks, you should be. But it's also helpful to keep in mind that the number of cases are still relatively small, 500 plus in Vermont in 2016. Still, given the difficulties associated with these illnesses and the fact that they're largely preventable, it's important to be informed. So today we're going to look at tick-borne diseases from an arachnological perspective. Yes, ticks are arachnids. And an epidemiological standpoint. So hold off on your questions about medical treatment. We will tackle that in another show, but that's not the focus for today. Let me introduce our guests for the show. Bradley Tompkins is a tick-borne disease program chief for the Vermont Health Department. Bradley, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Bill Landesman is a professor of biology at Green Mountain College. He studies ticks and the microbial ecology of tick-borne diseases. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show as well.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me, too.
So I am going to start in a way that is typically what we're not supposed to do as interviewers, which is to ask you both a series of yes or no questions, just to sort of get some of the facts out, and then we can go deeper into these issues. So let's talk about this whole thing about tick-borne diseases, specifically Lyme, on the rise. Bill Landesman, are there more ticks these days?
I know you said yes or no. I will say yes, but not necessarily in the past 3 years. Sorry.
Okay, so not necessarily in the past 3 years, but there are more ticks, generally speaking. Is it just that there are more ticks in Vermont, like more ticks in specific regions, or has the actual global volume of ticks, the actual number of ticks around the world, going up? Oh, no, maybe we lost Bill. Bradley Tompkins, you're on then.
Wow. Okay, thank you, Bill, for leaving me with that one. I think that what we're seeing at the health department is probably that there are more ticks, and that there are ticks moving into, at least as far as Vermont goes, into parts of Vermont where they weren't seen before. So it's probably a combination of that. And it's not only the ticks themselves, but it's also the diseases or the pathogens that they carry and how prevalent they are.
Right. And I want to talk about that too, but specifically to the ticks. If we know that ticks have been moving north, moving into regions that they haven't been before. So we're certainly seeing more ticks here, but are ticks sort of doing better globally than they used to be, and we're just seeing this tick volume increase, or is it more just we're seeing new ticks in new areas?
Mm-hmm. We're definitely seeing ticks increase in volume and then move into places where they haven't been before. CDC has certainly put together a lot of information on this, and they've been able to show that, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, counties in the United States that never reported having black-legged ticks now report having them. So I think it's a combination of both.
Okay. And so are more of the ticks that we have actually carrying disease than before?
That is a tough question. Some of the limited data that we have right now, particularly from our colleagues at the Agency of Agriculture, would indicate that for some of the diseases, yes. Lyme has been relatively stable over the last couple of years, where the infection rate in black-legged ticks that they've collected and tested have been around 50%. Anaplasmosis, the second most common tick-borne disease in Vermont, we've seen a bit of an increase over the last couple of years. And some of the other ones that we'll probably talk about, babesiosis and Borrelia miyamotoi, they're in very small numbers and haven't changed much.
When we think about the higher rates of illness, in 2006 in Vermont, there were 100 reported cases of Lyme disease. In 2016, there were 500 cases. So that has grown exponentially. Is the likelihood that the actual number of cases is rising that much, or is it that there's better reporting and better awareness so people go in when they think they might have that and doctors are more aware so they're more likely to actually diagnose it?
Mm-hmm.
Do we think that the actual transmission rate has quintupled, or is there some combination of increased transmission and increased reporting?
I think your second point is absolutely correct. It's a combination of factors. Certainly, as awareness becomes greater, both in the public and in the medical community, there's more testing. That leads to more reporting. But that's certainly not all the picture. There's definitely been a rise in cases that has nothing to do with, you know, better reporting or better surveillance.
I think we have Bill Landesman back on the line now. We had a problem with our studio setup, but Bill, you're on the line, on the phone with us now, right?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you great. Thank you for rejoining us. So we've been talking with Bradley Tompkins about some of the just the facts here when we look at an increase in Lyme disease in the United States and in Vermont, whether it's at an actual explosion of Lyme disease, whether it's increased reporting and what's happening with the ticks. And I know you didn't hear all of it, but what can you tell us to sort of give us this sort of overview of the increase in Lyme disease in particular nationwide and how Vermont relates?
Well, I think a lot of the increase is probably what you're seeing in New England. But a lot of the increase is due to tick-borne diseases, of course. And again, in New England, in New Hampshire, Maine, as well as Vermont, there's a lot of factors at play. I mean, the temperatures are getting warmer, and that is going to favor ticks. And to a certain extent, in addition to temperature, ticks like moisture and the forecast for the New England is that we're going to see wetter climate in the future. So those are likely to be factors in the expansion. You also, I agree with the reporting. And by the way, not to kind of have more negative news, but at the start of the show, you mentioned the number of cases, about 500 or so, but that's believed to be an underreporting by by 90%.
Right, a factor of 10. If there are 500 reported cases, we might actually be seeing 5,000 cases of people actually contracting Lyme disease in the state.
Although, it could be at least, especially nationwide. So the climate is helping the ticks expand. And there are also a lot of uncertainties in, with how virulent, the strain of Borrelia burgdorferi, that's the pathogen that causes Lyme disease. Are there changes in virulence? Are there changes in host immunity to the extent to which hosts can hold these pathogens and then transmit them to ticks? So a lot of factors like that could be coming into play, harder to pin down, though.
Hmm. So it's interesting then to talk about all of this, because it's not just, the reporting is simple that there's an increase and that's worrisome, but the reasons why are equally interesting and equally complex. And Bill Landesman just mentioned climate change and a wetter climate, a warmer climate. Bradley Tompkins, what about that question of a changing climate that's been bringing ticks north into Vermont? And we can see, as we see Lyme disease spread across the state, the populations of ticks moving.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got great colleagues at the health department who are climate change experts, and they feel strongly, after looking at the evidence, that climate change does play a role in the expansion or the increase in tick-borne diseases. I think another important factor to consider also is habitat change. So, this area of North America was completely forested, 1,000 years ago, and ancestors basically clear-cut it and probably pushed the tick and the host or the reservoir, the animals that carry this disease in nature, back. And over the last couple of hundred years, as we have reforested this area, we've done it in a fragmented way. All of our homes, where we are surrounded by forests, they're in tiny little patches. And those tiny little patches, they're beautiful and scenic for us, but they're also really good habitat for the best reservoir for Borrelia burgdorferi, the pathogen that causes Lyme disease. And that would be the white-footed mouse.
And when you say reservoir, just to clarify, what you're talking about are the mice carry Lyme disease, and that's how the ticks get them.
Yeah,
carry the pathogen.
Yeah, so at the essence here, we're talking about this in terms of ticks and being a vector-borne disease. At the very basic level, these are actually zoonotic diseases. White-footed mice, eastern chipmunks, shrews, even American robins, they're all competent reservoirs for Borrelia burgdorferi, which means the pathogen is circulating in their blood. And when a tick who doesn't happen to have the pathogen feeds on one of these animals, they then pick up the pathogen, and it's at that point during their next feeding stage that they end up transmitting the disease to humans.
So one of the interesting things is you go back in time here, Bradley, with talking about 1,000 years ago we had forest. And, you know, many of us, I think of Lyme disease as a fairly recent thing. I think it was first identified in 1975, famously in Old Lyme, Connecticut. That's its name.
Yep.
But there's some evidence that it has actually been around for like much, 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 much longer.
Yeah. Maybe as far back as 60,000 years in North America, certainly before the last ice age. You know, that's work that's been done at academic centers across the country. They looked at the genetics of not only the pathogen Borrelia burgdorferi, but also the black-legged tick. And they found that both of them were here before the last ice age, certainly before, you know, we were here as settlers. So you're right. It was only discovered within the last 40 or 45 years, but the disease and the vector for it have been here for a very long time.
I want to get into some of the questions that we're getting from listeners and go to Jane, who's calling in from Williston. Hi, Jane. Go right ahead.
Hello, Jane.
Hi, Jane.
My question is, I was listening to a really good piece on BPR a while ago about the moose population being decimated by ticks and how the ticks were actually forming in chains, which blew my mind, and then adhering to moose as they walked by, which of course made me think, oh my God, do they do that with other creatures like human beings, and can they actually organize themselves? So if I walk into the woods, there's going to be a chain of 3 or 10 or 20 or 100. I've never seen that before, but I'm just wondering if what affects the moose can also affect people.
Jane, thanks for the call. Bill Landesman, can you tackle that question?
I have read about that same fascinating phenomena, and I've never seen it in the black-legged tick. The winter tick that which is affecting the moose is a different species, and the harm it's causing to the moose is actually not a disease. It's that they're causing they're taking so much of the blood from the animal because they can, unlike deer where they just infect certain areas, a moose can be infected all over, and so they lose a lot of blood, they lose their hair, and they have a hard time surviving the winter. And in terms of that particular formation, I've never seen it, and so I'm not sure, but I don't think so.
Bill, do you know if ticks have any form of communication, the black-legged tick in particular? I mean, you mentioned that you haven't seen that chain formation, but do you know anything about tick communication?
Maybe not in the way we might normally think, but they can sense carbon dioxide in the environment, and so that's, in fact, you can use that as a way to collect ticks. So that's a type of, that's probably not the type of communication you're thinking about. Communication with one another. I don't know. They must have some way to get together. They mate, and so there must be some signaling going on, nothing that I'm really familiar with.
They're no honeybee.
I'm not aware of the similarities there, no.
Well, on that note, let's go to Susan, who's calling in from Waitsfield. Hi, Susan. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have Lyme disease, and it's been not pleasant. And a couple of concerns. One is that some people don't take this seriously, and I'm very concerned about that. I know people who do because they had children who picked up multiple ticks just sitting on a mowed lawn. So my question is this. We know that ticks are attracted by carbon dioxide. And rather than spray DEET all over ourselves, which I understand is the most effective thing we can apply to ourselves, is there some way to sort of mitigate the attraction to our CO2, or Is there some? Is there anything coming up fast that's going to help us with keeping ticks off of us?
Well, Susan, let me tackle those. And there's a couple different questions in there, and several. So first of all, highlighting that people should be taking this seriously, but then also questions about not only what could we put on our bodies, but is there a way to somehow mask our CO2 emissions or something like that? So, Bill, let me start with you, and then Bradley, I'll come to you on that.
Well, that's an interesting idea, and I've thought about harnessing the CO2 phenomena as a way to measure ticks. That would be a tough one. I'd still go back to advocating for, especially during the summertime, just rigorous tick checks, just like brushing your teeth twice a day. I know it's a lot of work. It's not ideal. But as a way to really minimize the risk there, I'd have to think about that CO2 question. It's a very intriguing one.
Right.
There are, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah, we can't really stop breathing for the duration of our time outside. So.
Well, you know, but of course, yeah, I think you're right. But is there management? You know, if you put a block of dry ice in the woods, which dry ice will is carbon dioxide and it will sublimate into CO2, and you can gather a lot of ticks that way. I don't know if it would be enough to clear out your entire woods, but you know, that's one thing that comes to mind.
That's interesting. So Susan also brought up the question of what's the best thing to put on your body or to address the way to repel ticks. And we can get more into how to do prevention in terms of clothing and stuff like that. But Bradley Tompkins, what about this question of chemicals to put on your body?
Yeah, so I recognize that a lot of people aren't crazy about the idea of DEET, but it has been proven to be both safe and effective. There are other commercial products out there that contain other active ingredients like picaridin. There's one called IR3535, oil of lemon eucalyptus. There are other products out there that have been, again, scientifically shown to be safe and effective at repelling ticks. And that's what we would encourage Vermonters to use. The EPA has got a really good website where you can go on there, and they've got a kind of like a search engine where you can specify the kind of tick or, say, mosquito that you would like to repel, how long you're going to be outside, and it will provide you with a list of not only the commercial product that is available, but also the active ingredient in it. So if you are interested in avoiding DEET, you can identify a commercial product that has an active ingredient that is not DEET using that website. And that's really where we want Vermonters to go.
We're going to put a link to that website up at vpr.net if you click on Vermont Edition so that we can direct people there. You mentioned a couple different – so DEET is proven effective at repelling ticks. You also mentioned – lemon eucalyptus oil. And this is something that we've gotten a few questions about. So this is a recommended tick repellent?
That one is, yeah. There are a lot of other oils that, you know, we see people talking about online, on social media, that have not been shown to be safe and effective. And so that's why we take this seriously at the health department, and prevention is the best thing to do about this. And so we want people to use scientifically established, scientifically proven methods for preventing tick bites.
What about permethrin? This is something you can often spray on your clothing. It's one of the active ingredients, I think, in tick repellents on dogs, for example, as well.
Yeah, permethrin is a great compound. It's something the hunters that I talk to, they swear by this. Now, this is something that you can't put on your skin because not only is it a repellent, but it's also an intoxicant, a contact intoxicant, which means that it does two things. It repels ticks, but it also kills them on contact. So what you can do is you can spray this on your clothing or on your gear, follow the instructions on the label for how to do that safely. You let your clothing or your gear dry, and then this permethrin is good for several wash cycles, so you don't have to reapply it each time. And as I said, it'll repel ticks. Any ones that do happen to get onto your clothing or gear should die within a short period of time.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Bill Landesman is a professor of biology at Green Mountain College who studies ticks and the microbial ecology of tick-borne diseases. Bradley Tompkins is the tick-borne disease program chief for the Vermont Health Department. We've been talking a little bit about how to maybe prevent ticks from biting you in the first place. And on that note, let's go to Julia, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Julia. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I was just telling the person on the phone.
Our call screener.
I proudly got my first tick on Sunday, I believe. And I did end up going to emergency. I didn't go to the emergency room. I went to the walk-in clinic at the health center down here. And the doctor said that she would prefer if more people did that because, you know, that way they can keep an eye on you as to whether you might eventually develop the symptoms of a disease. So, you know, just that caution. I want to ask the municipalities in the state. There are many trails around that people can take, you know, hiking trails, bike trails, whatever. But public facilities are usually not available. And so, you know, in my case, I think when I was answering the call of nature out there and I was in a really brushy spot outside view of the trail, I think that's when this tick climbed aboard. I don't think ticks move that fast. They don't jump. I don't think they're like spiders necessarily, although the biologist could probably correct me.
Well, Julia, we actually got a question about that. Bill Landesman, do ticks jump?
You sometimes hear that they can. I don't, maybe a very small distance, or they do latch on when you walk by. It seems to me there needs to be a little bit of a contact for them to get onto your clothing. But I'm sorry, I'm not actually sure. I've definitely heard that.
Bradley Tompkins is shaking his head vehemently. Bradley, you think no jumping?
Yeah, no jumping. Ticks need to they attach to their host through a process called questing, and so what they'll do is they'll get on the edge of a blade of grass or a very low hanging branch on brush, and they'll wait at the edge there for someone, a human or an animal, to pass by. As Bill said, they'll detect, you know, your carbon dioxide emission, and then they'll stick their front appendages out and wait for you to brush by. And at that point, that's when they attach to you. So to the caller's situation, that's one reason why at the health department we encourage people, hey, go out, hike, enjoy everything that Vermont has to offer in terms of outdoor activity, but stay in the center of the trail. Because if you do that, then you've reduced your risk of encountering a tick, because the center of the trail is beaten down. There's not a lot of brush or edge there for them to wait and latch on to you.
Although that's, of course, assuming that you're on a trail, that you're not sort of out in the fields, out in the tall grass. So, Bill Landesman, beyond chemicals, what are other ways to address that prevention idea in terms of both clothing you could wear, you know, whether you should be tucking your pants into your socks, but then also when and how to do your tick checks?
Well, these are all, yeah, the pants and the sock, great idea. The problem with preventing a tick bite, and there are products, DEET, permethrin, that you can use. You can avoid contact with vegetation, but you can do all of that. You could even get a tick bite by never going into the woods. Let's say your roommate or your partner goes out for a hike, you stay home, and then you use the car later. There could be a tick in the car. I really go back to just the tick checks and being aware, if you're in Vermont, especially all summer long, and when you do come back from being outdoors, and I think it was already mentioned, throwing your clothes in the dryer before you go too far into your home, that will kill the ticks. So you're not bringing them in. And if you can, shower, do a tick check. And even if you do a tick check, to do another tick check at the end of the day or in the morning, because you might miss one. And even when, I think it's really important, I think these low risk times are especially important. For example, in August or July and August, when the ticks start to go down in numbers, you might think that you're safe, but they can still be out there. Or if you're using a spray, you never know. So I go back to you could take all these precautions, but just keep checking. It's unfortunate, it's inconvenient, but it could really reduce the risk.
Well, and another possible way to get it, if you have an outdoor dog who, and for example, in my case, sleeps in the bed. You know, you never know what your dog might be bringing in. So maybe don't have them sleep in the bed, I suppose. But also, you know, there are certainly ways that animals can bring them in. So Bradley Tompkins, one of the things that I've been seeing a lot lately is a lot of questioning about the official statements on how long it takes for a tick to be attached before it can transmit Lyme disease to you. A lot of skepticism about that 24-plus hour time frame, but also then you look at some of the official reports, and often what I'm seeing is they say, in most cases, it takes more than 24 hours. So what is the latest on how long it takes?
Right. So there is no magic number. It's really a continuum from very little risk of transmission to very high risk of transmission. And sure, there are the outside aberrant cases where there might be transmission within a brief period of time. But by and large, all of the studies have shown that transmission for Borrelia burgdorferi that causes Lyme disease at least does take 24 to, say, 48 hours. And we get a lot of questions about that at the health department as well. And to me, it's not that important. We want people to remove the tick as soon as they find it. So I wouldn't encourage somebody who finds a tick on them and thinks it's been on there for 2 hours to wait another 5 hours to remove it simply because they think they've got 24 hours.
I don't know anybody who would want a tick on them longer than it has to be. I think the bigger question is then how vigilant do you need to be if you find a tick that maybe has just started to burrow its way in? Like, do you need to call your doctor? Do you need to be really vigilant about monitoring? Or can you sort of take that easy?
I think if you find a tick attached to you, you need to monitor your health for the next 30 days to look for signs or symptoms of a tick-borne disease. You don't necessarily have to call your doctor, but if you want to, you know, they might choose to see you about that. But if you find a tick attached to your body, then yes, you should be monitoring your health for the next 30 days.
Let's go to Lolly, who's calling in from Danville. Hi, Lolly. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I'm one of those people that probably had Lyme for many, many years before it was discovered, and I tested positive for anaplasmosis, Bartonella, and Borrelia. And I'm curious to know, you know, when I'm out walking with friends or something, and a tick is on my neck or whatever, you know, you can feel it, and you pull it off, and I'm just terrified of getting it again. And so, you know, like a friend will go, oh, that's just a dog tick. That's not going to give you Lyme. Can you talk a little bit about, like, the size of ticks? You know, I've pulled one off my granddaughter's back that was a tiny little nymph, like the top of a straight pen. I can never get clear on that. And I've read a million books. I've searched. So I'm really glad to hear this broadcast today.
Well, thanks for your questions. And let's take this in two parts again. So Bill Landesman, maybe you could help describe what the different stages of a black-legged tick look like and how to differentiate that from other ticks. And then, Bradley, I want to talk about other kinds of diseases that can be transmitted, not just by black-legged ticks, but by other ones. So, Bill, tell us how to identify a black-legged tick.
It's not going to be the most helpful answer because it's best to have a microscope to do it. They're going to be the nymphs especially, and that's the second stage in a tick's life cycle. They're the size of the pinhead. They're the hard ones to see, they might be difficult to distinguish. The mouth parts are maybe the easiest. If you have a magnifying glass, they're a little bit longer and more slender on the black-legged tick versus the dog tick. I should mention in Rutland County, where I do most of my sampling, I've really only ever seen the black-legged tick. These other ticks are certainly out there. But if you're in southern Vermont, I think there's a high probability that it's the black-legged tick. It's certainly, there could be others. And I think, I know Bradley will take this, the second part, but all of these ticks carry other diseases. I mean, but the ones we see most in Vermont are from the black-legged tick, but the dog tick will have diseases as well.
Hmm. So Bradley, yeah, go ahead, Bill.
The larval stage of the black-legged tick, which would be, you might not even notice that it's on you until they've engorged, but those are believed to be free of pathogens. But those are extremely small, very, very hard to see.
So Bradley Tompkins, it sounds like no matter what kind of tick it is, you should be aware that, you know, if you see it, you should be monitoring your health. What are some of the other diseases that we're seeing in both black-legged ticks and potentially in other ticks?
Mm-hmm. So by far and away, most of the diseases that we deal with at the health department that we see reported to us are caused by the black-legged tick. In fact, you know, I can't think of a situation where we have had a case reported to us of a tick-borne disease that was transmitted by a different kind of tick. You know, as Bill said, the American dog tick is capable of transmitting other diseases, but that's never happened here in Vermont. It really happens in other parts of the country more. So for us, the focus is really the black-legged tick, and that's because it transmits and causes five different diseases in New England and particularly in Vermont. Of course, Lyme disease, as we've talked about. Anaplasmosis is the second most common tick-borne disease, again, transmitted by the black-legged tick. Babesiosis, which is actually a parasitic. It's a parasite, not a bacteria, so it requires a little bit of a different treatment. There's a relatively new one. It's been newly recognized in the U.S. within the last 5 years and in Vermont within the last two, called Borrelia miyamotoi. And then there's one that's really rare called Powassan virus disease. We haven't had a case of it in Vermont reported since 1999, but we know that the pathogen is here in the black-legged tick population because, again, colleagues at agriculture have found that. But those are the five diseases that we're really most concerned about at the health department.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Bradley Tompkins is Tick-Borne Disease Program Chief for the Vermont Department of Health. Bill Landesman studies ticks and microbial ecology of tick-borne diseases as a professor of biology at Green Mountain College. Bill, you're doing actually quite a bit of research into the ticks themselves, and we've talked about some of your research in past shows and especially the fascinating work you're doing on the microbiome of the tick. But ultimately, what's your goal? I mean, is it to try to figure out how to create a vaccine? Is it just to have a better understanding? I mean, where do you hope your research actually takes us in terms of the future of these diseases?
Okay, so there's two possible pathways for this research. Well, they're both, I'm working on, there are two possible outcomes. And with the microbiome, we're referring to all the bacteria, fungi, protists, et cetera, viruses that live in or on the tick. And we're in my lab at Green Mountain College, we're trying to understand if this microbiome, if these species have an effect on disease transmission. Do they interact with Borrelia burgdorferi and make it more likely or to colonize a tick and make the tick infected? And do they aid the tick in acquiring Borrelia burgdorferi, and or do they aid the tick in just being fit and able to be active and reproduce? And so that's one line of research. And so we're looking right now just for correlations. We're looking at this entire microbial community and see which differs from tick to tick, and trying to understand if this microbial signature, which varies from tick to tick, if that's correlated with different levels of infection with Borrelia burgdorferi. The second pathway of this research is to understand if what drives this variation in microbiome. And one promising area of research is that it appears that ticks that have fed on different host species, in other words, a tick that feeds off an opossum versus a white-footed mouse, does that change their microbiome? And the answer from our early research seems to be yes. The next question is, does that does that really matter? And so that's what we're working on.
So to what end do you hope that at some point there's a vaccine? Do you hope that at some point we have, in the same ways that we do some forms of insect control, that we might apply that to ticks? I know you don't necessarily have to be doing that research, but where do you hope your research then leads us?
Well, it's theoretically possible that that one day down the line, one could alter the microbiome of a tick through various tricks, and for example, there are some species out there that seem to be inversely correlated with Borrelia burgdorferi. In other words, when they are in high abundance, Borrelia is in low abundance. Could we somehow alter the tick microbiome to make them resistant to Borrelia? It's really a long shot. It's hard to envision what that would look like. My research primarily is what you would call basic science research, adding to the body of knowledge of microbiomes and of disease ecology, in the hopes that this will allow for future discoveries. And so much of science works that way, where someone will come up with a technique, and it gets used in ways that were never imagined. So that's part of it too. Overall, at the very least, increase our understanding of why some ticks are infected and others are not. And then we can look at what are some practical applications, hopefully somewhere down the road.
Well, on that idea, Tom wrote in to say, I'm a landscaper. I find ticks every day and have been bitten many times. And then Tom says, isn't the dog vaccine the same that was available to people? What happened? So Bradley Tompkins, what happened? There was a vaccine for a short time.
There was, around the turn of the century. And it got removed from the marketplace by the manufacturer. My understanding is that there is a new vaccine in development. It's undergoing some clinical trials right now. So there could be a vaccine available for humans for Lyme disease in the future. But, there's no telling at this point in time.
And when you say turn of the century, you mean turn of this last century? So like around 99, 2000, not around 1900?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Sorry. 2000s.
No, it makes absolute sense. It was the turn of the century. But what about other ideas for potential prevention of transmission that you're seeing? I mean, so vaccine may be in development. Mm-hmm. Are there other things that are coming down the pike that we should be aware of?
Yeah, there are. There's a very big study underway next door in New York State where they're looking at some landscape interventions to try to knock down the tick population. That's a multi-year project that's just started within the last couple of years. So we'll be interested in the results of that when they come out. There's also pretty far out there use of CRISPR technology, which is being thought about as an experiment to use on off the coast of New England. And the idea behind that is that you would introduce a population of white-footed mice that are incapable of being a reservoir for Borrelia burgdorferi, and see if that can knock down the incidence of Lyme disease in humans on that particular island. So that would certainly be easier to do on an island than it would do in the continental United States. And that's, pretty pie in the sky research right now that they're just considering. So the prevention tips that, we've talked about today and that we have outlined on our website are, really where we think Vermonters need to be focused this spring and summer.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about prevention, but in terms of recognizing when something may be wrong and then being able to advocate for yourself with your medical professionals, what are some of the symptoms of these diseases that people should be looking out for? Because you don't always notice when you've been bitten by a tick.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of people who do come down with a tick-borne disease don't ever recall having a tick bite. So we would encourage people who go to their healthcare provider who have symptoms consistent with a tick-borne disease, if they don't recall a tick bite, tell your provider about your outdoor activities. If you're an avid hiker or hunter, your gardener, spend a lot of time outdoors, that might be all that you need to sort of get over that hump and be tested if your provider thinks that your symptoms are consistent with a tick-borne disease.
But like what? What symptoms?
Unfortunately, they're all pretty vague for most of these different diseases. You know, Lyme disease is classically associated with this bullseye rash called the erythema migrans rash. It often looks like a bullseye, but sometimes it doesn't. It might just look like a generic rash. It might not even appear all of the time. Only about 70% of the cases in Vermont ever report having a rash. So some of the other symptoms that we encourage people to look out for are, again, pretty general: fever, headache, muscle ache, fatigue. For anaplasmosis and babesiosis, people might experience nausea and vomiting. Really, the only way to get diagnosed with most of these tick-borne diseases is to go to a healthcare provider and have a laboratory test done. Lyme disease can be clinically diagnosed, meaning a provider can, you know, visually assess you, take your temperature, whatnot, look for that rash, and diagnose you that way. But for anaplasmosis and babesiosis, and in some cases of Lyme, you really need that test to get a diagnosis.
I want to make sure we have time before we end to talk about something that you're actually looking for the public's help in, Bradley, in terms of identifying a different kind of tick that you think may be in Vermont.
Yeah, so everything we've talked about so far today has been about the black-legged tick because it causes the most disease, almost all the disease in Vermont. But over the last couple of decades, there's been this geographic expansion in the United States of a different tick. It's called the Lone Star tick. The tick has been found in all of our neighboring states, but has never been officially documented here in Vermont. We've gotten secondhand report from Vermonters that they might have found the tick, but we want to scientifically document if, in fact, that tick is here because it behaves differently than the black-legged tick, and it is, in fact, capable of transmitting some different diseases. So this year, we're launching a project. We call it Project Lone Star, where we're asking Vermonters who encounter what they think to be a Lone Star tick to save it. Go to our website. We're just setting it up, I think, probably as we speak back in the office. And you can go there, get some visual cues to help you think about whether or not it is, in fact, a Lone Star tick. And if you do believe that it is, we ask you to send it into the health department. We're going to positively identify it. And then we're going to try to go out to the location where you think you found the Lone Star tick, and we're going to do some systematic surveillance there to see if we can capture it, because that's how you, for lack of a better term, put Vermont on the map as being a place where the Lone Star tick is present.
So, Bill Landesman, for you, anything that you think? I know you don't have a big citizen science project, but what do you think, as we leave this conversation, people should be thinking about and aware of as they recreate this summer?
Well, just not to let it keep you from going outside. It's still a beautiful state, and I hope that people still enjoy nature and just deal with this slightly inconvenient. Well, or if you become sick, it's more than slightly, but the inconvenience of a tick check. And you're right. I don't have a citizen science project, but anyone in the Rutland County area who has anything they'd like to share with me, they could certainly email me at the college. And I'm especially interested. A lot of people will tell me that they have a very ticky property, and that's useful to know. I'm also especially interested in people who don't see many ticks at all, because that helps us to understand what's driving tick populations, to know where there are fewer ticks, and especially in deciduous forests, because there is a wide range. So there are some sites but there are not many ticks at all. So those are people can reach out to me informally and about that. But just keep going outside.
Yes, keep going outside, and let our guests today know if you see anything that you think might be interesting. Bill Landesman is a professor of biology at Green Mountain College. Bradley Tompkins is the Tick-Borne Disease Program Chief for the Health Department. Thanks very much to both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jane.